bore the impact. Say the bone was reset by a field surgeon, and it was agonizing, white, hot, searing pain. With such detail, the story is at least realistic. When I looked back to Tomas, he gave a pointed nod towards Saul, and I swallowed. Because clearly the medical knowledge was second nature to Saul, spilling out of him even at this point, when his mind was full of grief and pain. I could see why Tomas thought that was important, but it only underlined the decision we'd already made, that Tomas would stay and Saul would go. Brilliant surgeon or not, the man was currently sitting on the floor of the cellar, intermittently weeping, and every now and then there were periods when he'd fall completely silent, to rock back and forth like a child, holding that tiny leather shoe against his cheek. The most responsibility I'd ever experienced before was when I had to find Amelia a temporary home. It had been overwhelming and terrifying, and this dwarfed that by miles. Not only was I now a reluctant courier of Henry's photographs, but I would also be dragging along behind me a man who had just suffered unimaginable tragedy and trauma. Instead of following Tomas, I'd have to lead the way. Tomas leaned all the way over my arm now, assuming quite an awkward posture and momentarily blocking my view of the cast he was constructing. Unthinkingly, I reached up to touch the thick locks of his hair. He desperately needed a haircut, and it was almost irrational how much I wished we had the time for me to do that for him once more. Such a small thing, but it would have been so lovely to nurture him in that way, as if that could remind him while we were apart how deeply I cared for him. When he sat up, he smiled at me, sadly.
"It's going to be fine, you know. You are going to be fine."
"And you'll find me," I said, not for the first time. In fact, I'd been repeating this almost the entire walk back from the Goloshevsky farm, checking, then double and triple checking that I still understood the plan. "You'll get this sorted here, and you'll make the same journey. You'll meet us at Buzuluk."
"That's exactly right."
"And if the camp won't accept that your passport belongs to Saul?"
"Then you will find a way to make them accept him."
"And if they catch us before we get to the Soviet border, what do I do then?"
"That won't happen."
He dismissed the mere suggestion as if it was entirely impossible, which made me impatient and somewhat furious, given there was no way for us to know how safe this plan was. For all we knew, the Nazis intercepting me was the likely outcome, and I knew I had to be prepared.
"Answer me, Tomas. If we are intercepted before we even leave the district, and Saul has a passport with your name on it, what exactly am I to do then?"
"It won't."
"We both know it's a possibility," I exclaimed. Then I lowered my voice. "They were already looking for you at Warsaw because you deserted the Wehrmacht. And now they are looking for you locally because Jan told them about your work for Zagota."
Tomas sighed and nodded.
"So tell me, what do I do if we are caught?"
Who was this woman, staring bravely into the face of danger? She had been with me all along. I'd seen glimpses of her that day at the square when I saved Amelia, then again when I had decided to support Tomas despite the danger. I was nearing full flight now, and only a trace remained of the scared little girl I'd once been. Tomas stared intently at the bandage as he wound it around and around my forearm. The lump of the long canister slowly disappeared into the bulk. After a while, he whispered,
If something happens to you and the film is lost, there is nothing we can do about that. Henry might have different instructions when we meet with him at the pickup point, but for me..." He finally looked up at me, and his eyes swam in fresh tears. "I simply have to believe you'll make it. I have to believe you're going to be cursing me in a few days' time, when you're magnificently free in Soviet territory. But the cast is starting to itch, and you can't reach beneath the plaster to scratch it. That is the only way I can watch you go.
I reached up with my left hand and cupped his jaw, and he rested his head against my palm.
I hate it when we're apart, Alina. I hate it. But there is just no other way.
You're sure this is the right thing for us to do? I whispered. He stared right into my eyes, and he nodded.
I have never been more sure of anything in my life.
I exhaled, then sat up a little straighter.
Okay then, Thomas. Okay.
My confidence came and went in waves, and I was once again second-guessing the whole plan as we approached the meeting point. Tomas was no longer marching in strides ahead of me. He was behind me, all but dragging Saul, who was struggling to keep up. Tomas kept reminding us that we had to hurry. We couldn't afford to miss the truck. Every time he said it, I couldn't help but wonder if we'd all be better off if we did. Henry was waiting for us, pacing beside the main road. The dawn was near and the darkness was disappearing by the second. And once he saw us, he sprinted toward us. I saw the confusion on his face as it registered that we had a third person in our party.
They may have Nadia, and they're looking for me, Tomas called before Henry could ask. We have to hurry.
Henry stared at us, his gaze lingering on the cast on my arm.
What has happened? Saul is going in my place, and they need to leave now.
Henry fell silent for a moment. When the moment began to stretch, Tomas stepped toward the older man, and he dropped his voice, so low that I could barely hear it.
There is no time, Henry, Tomas murmured. They know who I am, what I've been doing. Soon enough, they will be looking for me if they aren't already. Jakub needs to get on the road as fast as he can, in case they set up checkpoints. There is just no time for debate.
Tomas, Henry said, lips pursed. Are you sure about this?
There is no other way.
Henry sighed and ran his hand through his hair, then threw his hands into the air and turned to me.
You have the film?
I do.
You have the rubles?
I patted the leather bag I'd slipped across my shoulders, now hidden under my clothes. I do.
And you know the plan, he said,
as he withdrew from the pocket of his coat a small envelope. I nodded, and he held the envelope right before me.
Here is a new identity card for you, in the name of Hannah Vishnievsky. It's a forgery, and not a particularly convincing one. But it is the best I could do on such short notice. So you will have to make it work.
I took the envelope and moved to put it into the pocket of my coat. Henry shook his head and said incredulously,
Tuck it into your undergarments, Alina. You must protect this with your life. Do you understand me? No identity papers means no admission to the camp, and the British soldiers will be looking for my film inside the camp.
Tears stung at my eyes, but I blinked them away as I pushed the envelope beneath my clothes into the leather bag with the rubles. Henry looked from me to Saul, and he gave me a somewhat desperate look.
Dear God, he muttered. This is...
Henry, Alina is up to this, Tomas said flatly. She will get that film where it needs to go. She's every bit as resourceful and capable as I am. Now let's go.
I grabbed Henry's arm frantically. If we happen to get captured, is there anything I can do? He exhaled heavily, then gave me a searching look.
If you're captured and there's time, destroy the film. Find a way. Otherwise, we must just hope that whatever happens to your body, that your captors don't pay attention to the cast. Because if they find that film, it won't be long before they find me and my colleagues, too. We stood by the side of the road discussing the possibility of our executions, as if it was nothing much at all. Because in the scheme of things, it wasn't. In that circumstance, death was simply one of many things that could happen. Okay, I said stiffly. Got it. Henry led the way down a track, and soon the truck came into view. I hadn't prepared myself for the sight of a man in a Wehrmacht uniform, leaning against the truck, smoking a cigarette. It was all I could do to stop myself from turning and running in the opposite direction. That's Jakub, Henry said quietly. And of course it was, because who else could drive openly on the roads to the Eastern Front but a Wehrmacht driver, driving a Wehrmacht truck? I just hadn't prepared myself for the sight of it. I hesitated and once again drew Henry's ire. We must hurry, Alina. You know what's at stake here, girl. It took more strength than I'd ever realized I possessed to start my feet walking again and move toward the man in that uniform, than to place my life in his hands. I'm Jakub, the driver said as we neared. Alina, I said automatically. No, Henry corrected me impatiently. You are not Alina. Who are you? I looked at him, but my mind was blank.
I can't remember.
Hanna Wisniewski, Henry said impatiently. You are Hanna Wisniewski. You know the plan? Jakob glanced between us, his brows drawing. I swallowed hard as I nodded. Jakub frowned toward Tomas, who was now jogging toward us, carrying Saul in his arms.
Who's going? There's definitely no room for a third in there.
Just me and Saul. The man being carried, I said miserably. Jakub winced.
Are you sure you're up for this lady?
Of course she is, Tomas said flatly, having finally caught up to us. Inside the truck, I could see the row of rations boxed against the deepest wall, behind several barrels and other loose containers. Jakub helped me to climb up into the tray, and Tomas did the same for Saul, then leaped up to stand beside me. Henry was standing at ground level, but he was watching us and wringing his hands.
You must be sure you are quiet, Jakub said. Perhaps you can whisper or talk quietly when we're out on the road. But if the truck slows for any reason or it stops, you must assume I'm doing a delivery or picking up, and then be absolutely silent. So much as a cough or a sneeze, and not only are you both dead, but so am I.
What are you transporting?
I had a sudden terror that we'd be hidden in the back of a truck filled with explosives. Just one more thing to be terrified of. Death by accidental explosion.
Just fresh fruit and vegetables grown by the prisoners at Auschwitz, he said. Then he added bitterly, the senior officers on the front line demand fresh produce. All the better if it's drenched in the blood of our people.
Jakub walked to the boxes. He slipped a screwdriver from his pocket, opened a panel, and then helped Saul to climb inside. Tomas turned to me, and I caught his face between my palms and I searched his gaze desperately, looking for some sign of hesitance that I could exploit to convince him to come with me like we'd planned. He seemed only determined, and when I recognized this, I felt all of my courage slipping away all over again, replaced instead by sheer panic.
I don't want to do this, I choked, riding on one final wave of hesitance. I can't.
You can, Tomas simply whispered, smoothing my hair down against my head, peppering my face with soft kisses. I know you can.
What? Instead, let me stay with you until you can go too. Saul can go on his own.
Alina, you already have the cast on, he said very gently. Henry has arranged for us only because of that film.
There is no other way.
But we could...
I started to protest, but my voice trailed off. We could... what? There was no more plaster, and no way to get our hands on any more. If we took the cast off, we'd have to think of another way to smuggle the film out. And this one thing had been difficult enough to arrange. Tomas reached to touch my chin, lifting my gaze back to his. Saul can't go on his own, Alina. His gaze flicked behind me. Then he added softly, He's broken, my love. He's barely holding himself together.
But what if you never find me?
Alina, he said very softly. Don't you know by now?
Don't say it.
I choked, and I shook my head fiercely.
Don't you dare say it when you're putting me into this truck and sending me off by myself.
But Alina, Tomas whispered, and he lifted his hand to press the pad of his forefinger against my lips. It is the only truth I live by. Everything else is gone. We are made for each other, meant to be together. It doesn't matter what happens in this life or the next, Alina. We'll always find our way back to each other.
But what if you can't find me?
I wept, and he brushed my tears away, and he said very quietly, Just promise me one last thing, he said now, his eyes flicking briefly to the crate behind me. Take good care of Saul. Tomas tucked his forefinger under my chin, prompting me to meet his gaze. Promise me, Alina. He is a good man, a better man than I am. Think of the people he can help with the skills he has. You must take care of him for as long as he needs you to. I never could say no to Tomas, especially not that day. I could tell by the stubborn set of his jaw and the fierce determination in his gaze that these things he was asking of me meant the world to him. First, I had to walk away from him. And if that wasn't already an impossible task, then I had to continue his work in helping Saul to escape. Promise, Alina? Tomas asked me one last time. I closed my eyes because I couldn't look at him while I did so. But then I nodded. Good girl. He reached forward and kissed me again then. This kiss was different from any other we'd shared. It was a plea, a promise, and a farewell. When we broke apart, he was softly crying, and my heart was threatening to pound its way through the wall of my chest. I wanted to beg him to find any other way, but I knew it was pointless to do so, and besides, there was no time left for cowardice. I crawled into the crate then, and as I'd feared, it was tiny, barely a foot wide in the width of the truck across. The scent of the pine and of dust was overwhelming. There would be enough room for us both to sit, and enough room for us to stand at a crouch so we could turn around if we needed to. I sat behind Saul and closed my eyes. Just then, I felt Tomas reach inside to press two fingers gently against my lips. What is your name? He asked me. Your new name. My mind was blank and I began to panic all over again.
I don't know, Tomas. I already don't remember. I can't do...
Hanna Vizhnievsky, Henry called impatiently. Repeat it in your mind until it sticks, Alina. Learn it.
You learn it too,
I said, frantically clutching Tomas's hand before he could withdraw it.
You'll need to know what name I'm using so you can find me, right?
I have already memorized it, my love. Your name is Hanna Vizhnievsky, Tomas whispered. Travel safely, Hanna.
I will,
I said, as bravely as I could, given I was only just holding the sobs at bay.
I'll see you at Buzuluk.
And then Tomas and Jakub sealed the door, and Saul and I were trapped alone in the darkness.
Are you okay?
I whispered to Saul. Do you think this is how they feel? He whispered back. I could hear the rising panic in his voice.
Who?
My family, in that grave, he said, his voice a little louder now. The suffocation, the darkness. It would feel like this, wouldn't it?
Every muscle in my body tensed. For a minute, his words sent me into such a spiraling panic that I almost convinced myself that I was in a grave. But I forced myself to push down the panic and return to the present reality.
One breath at a time, Alina. Breathe in. Oh, I found some air. Breathe out. That will be the last of me. Now I will suffocate. Breathe in. Oh, there is a little more air after all.
No, I choked up the words he needed, even if I didn't believe them myself at the time. I don't think this is how they feel. I think they are freed from feelings like this. I think they are waiting for you on the other side, and they are safe and at peace.
I felt him relax then, even though his only answer was a muffled sob.
Chapter 34 Alice. As Zofia and I begin our second trip toward Trebinia, she chatters as she drives, falling automatically into tour guide mode. I keep zoning out as she's speaking. All of this information really is interesting, but the truth is my mind is elsewhere. I'm thinking about these wide-open days ahead of me and the fact that I have absolutely no idea what to do with them. And even more disturbing, Mom's words on the phone last night are swirling around my mind, giving me all sorts of crazy ideas. Sometimes you have to smash the damn door down. What's the plan? Zofia asks me when we turn off the highway into the little town. I sigh and lean back in my chair. I'm about to say I don't know, but then it occurs to me that in all of the places we visited yesterday, only one revealed a lead. To the clinic again, please, I say. I ask Zofia to stay in the car this time, hoping that Leo will be more open to me if I go into the clinic alone. Cousin to cousin, Zofia suggests with a grin. Something like that, I say. I'm sick with nerves remembering how determined Leo was yesterday that she couldn't help me, but I force myself to march into the clinic. Leah actually groans when she sees me in the reception area, and I hold up my hands as if that will placate her. Come with me, she says abruptly, and she swipes the headset from her head to throw it onto the desk. I wave to her companion and offer a weak, hi.
Hello, he says uncertainly.
I follow Leah down the hallway, then turn into the meeting room. I told you, she greets me with audible frustration, and I hold my hands up again and try to make her understand. Listen, I say very quietly, you're my only lead, and I can tell that you love your grandmother just as much as I love mine, so I understand why you don't want to help me, but I hope you can understand my position too. The only concrete thing I've found since I arrived here is her childhood home, which isn't giving up any secrets, and you. So, okay, there really does seem to be some confusion about my pa and your Thomas Schlosky. But if you can spare me a few minutes, perhaps we can resolve that. You said Emilia still visits his grave, right? She does, Leah says. Sadness leaps into her gaze, and in that instant, I know she's not lying about this. Every month. She used to go more often when she was younger. He was her hero. Okay, I say. Then I suck in a breath and ask hopefully, so, can you tell me where the grave is? Leah hesitates just a little, and I adjust the strap of my handbag because I'm too nervous to be still while I wait for her answer. The silence stretches some more, and I try to make a joke. I promise not to camp out there for a month and bully my way into seeing your grandmother. I'd just like to see it. Fine, Leah sighs. She walks across the room to a cabinet and withdraws a piece of paper and a pen. She sets both onto the board table in the center of the room, then scrawls down an address. It's not easy to find. You have to drive out of town. Follow the main road. It curves around behind the hill you can see to the east from pretty much any point in town. There's an old property there. This is the street address. We drive all the way onto the farm, but my grandmother has the only key to the gate,
so you'll have to park in the driveway and jump the fence. I know exactly the place she's describing. There's no way it can be anywhere but Babcia's family home. Still, I'm too nervous to get my hopes up, so I interrupt her gently to ask, "Is this Sveltoyanska 4, I say. Predictably, I totally muddle the pronunciation on the street name, but not so much that Leah doesn't understand it, because her gaze narrows.
I don't understand, she scowls. You already know where this is?
That house, I say, but my voice comes out a little husky, so I pause to clear my throat. Then I ask, why is the grave behind that house?
The house is abandoned. It has been since the war. Not even the communists wanted it, Leah tells me. But he's not buried there at the house. He's buried on the hill behind it.
I'm just directing you to the house because it's much easier to get to the grave from that side than from the town side now. There are new houses all along the hill on this side, so the path is blocked.
But that particular spot? Why there on that hill?
Leah passes me the paper and frowns.
I have no idea. Now tell me, how did you know that address?
It was my grandmother's childhood home, I tell her, and her eyes widen. There's an awkward pause while she ponders this. Then Leah concedes,
well, that is quite a coincidence.
Surely that can't be a coincidence, I say incredulously.
This entire area was overrun by Nazis. There are unfortunate souls buried in every conceivable place around here. My great uncle is lucky he at least has a headstone. But I'll be honest with you. I have no idea how he came to be buried there. My grandmother isn't exactly keen to discuss the worst days of her life on a regular basis, you know. She won't talk about the war, and we've given up asking her.
I laugh weakly as I nod. I know exactly what that's like.
That's actually why I can't let you talk to her, Leah says softly. She's like a different woman on the days when we visit his grave. It costs her something to honor his memory, and I won't ask more of her than that. But if it helps you, by all means visit the grave.
She shrugs.
I just don't think there's anything more I can do to help you beyond this one thing, okay?
Thank you, I say. Then I throw myself at her and hug her. She stiffens, then returns the hug briefly and nods toward the door.
Good luck.
Half an hour later, Zofia and I stand at a clearing in the woods behind my grandmother's childhood home, staring at the creepiest thing I have ever seen. Thomas Schlosky, 1920 to 1942. His name is etched into the polished red granite of a tall headstone. The stone is clean, clearly lovingly maintained. A semi-fresh set of mixed flowers is dying on the grass in front of the stone, and it's surrounded by clean candles, the wicks unlit now, but black from prior use. There's even a few LED lanterns in various shapes and sizes. Zofia bends and turns one of the lanterns on, and it lights up without delay. I look back to the stone and stare at the name again. This time, I notice that below the name and dates, a medal has been attached to the headstone. The inscription on the medal is in Hebrew. Zofia and I stare silently at the grave for a while, like it's a puzzle we can solve if we just stare long enough. But it's not long before I find I just can't look at it any longer. I turn away and exhale shakily.
Poor Emilia, Zofia murmurs.
I glance back at her and find she's crouching close to the metal. She runs her finger over the characters very gently.
This is the medal awarded to the righteous among the nations. It indicates that this Thomas Schlosky took great personal risk during the war to aid Jewish people. It means his name is listed on the wall of honor in the Garden of Righteous in Jerusalem.
She pauses, then bows her head.
It is a big deal, truly a huge honor.
This is just awful, I say, and I stand and frown. I'm feeling suddenly irritable, as if my skin has grown too tight, and I shiver because despite the sweltering day, there's a chill running down my spine as I stare at a grave that I know is not my grandfather's, despite the fact that grandfather's name is on it. It's just so creepy, isn't it?
My hand twitches against the phone in my hand, and I raise it to take a photo, but as soon as I do, I lower the phone in a rush. Zofia stands and offers me a questioning glance.
I can't show her, I blurt. It will upset her so much.
Zofia inclines her head in acknowledgement.
But this is quite the mystery, no?
It's Pa's name, and that's the year he was born, but this obviously can't be Pa.
No, Zofia agrees softly, and she stands. But Emilia Schlosky doesn't know that.
How could this happen? I whisper. Do you think this is what Babcia sent us for? To tell Pa's sister the truth?
There's no way to answer that question, and I'm not surprised when Zofia remains silent. We stare at the grave for another few minutes in silence. Then she asks me, how did your grandparents get to the U.S.?
I don't even know. All I know is that Mom was born in January 43, and they were already settled there by then.
Zofia frowns.
That can't be right.
I stand and look at her quizzically.
No, I'm sure it is.
They must have left before the war.
I know they were here when the war began. That's about all I do know, actually.
But they left during the occupation?
They must have.
That's difficult to believe. Zofia shakes her head slowly, her eyebrows knitted. It was all but impossible to get out of Nazi-held territory.
All I know is that they came on a boat from England. I have no idea how they got from here to England.
Zofia exhales. Then she looks at the headstone again.
I'm just thinking aloud here, but do you think Emilia might have assumed her brother died, but he was actually on his way to America? She must have been very young when this happened. Perhaps she or someone else even mistook another body for his. Because if this guy died in 1942, and Thomas fled from Poland in 1942,
that might be the only explanation, I say. My throat feels tight with tears that I will probably shed later, because while I don't understand this at all, the only thing I know for sure is that this is utterly tragic for Emilia Schlosky. This is a really strange place for a grave, right?
Perhaps this was just where he died, Zofia suggests.
Behind my grandmother's house?
Plenty of people hid in patches of woods during the war.
And was it my grandfather who was the hero saving Jews, or this other guy? I glance back at the headstone one last time, and a shiver runs down my spine. I remember Pa so well. I just can't imagine him letting his sister think he was dead for all of those years. It's much easier to imagine him taking heroic measures to help his countrymen, because he was one of the most giving men I've ever met.
Zofia, I ask quietly.
Yes?
Do you have any idea how we can untangle this without Emilia's input, or whether or not we should even tell her, even if we do happen to get access to her?
Zofia gives me a sad smile.
I hate to say this, Alice, but I think the only way forward here is via Leah Trukin.
I leave Zofia in the car again when I step into the clinic for a fourth time. I feel like I made better progress this morning, and maybe there were even a few moments there where Leah and I really connected. I find that she's serving a patient when I enter the room, but her companion sees me, and he elbows her gently, then points to me. There's visible frustration in Leah's gaze as she stares at me, but then she fixes a smile to her face, finishes serving her patient, and leads the way back to the meeting room.
Leah, I take a deep breath, then blurt, I saw the grave. It's definitely my grandfather's name and year of birth, but it can't be him because he only died last year. It seems to me that the only way we're ever going to understand this is if you or even I could talk to Emilia.
Listen, Alice, Leah says flatly.
I feel for you. I really do. I've done everything I can to help you. What you're asking for now is simply impossible. Maybe you could just mention Alina.
Every month we take her to visit that grave, Leah says abruptly. On the very last Sunday of every month, she goes to Mass in her very best clothes, then she stops for flowers at the market, and then us grandkids have a roster, and we all take turns driving her up there. And do you know why we each take turns?
When I shake my head, Leah's gaze grows sharp.
Because, Alice, nearly 80 years after he died, my beautiful, brave grandmother still cries sometimes when she sees his grave, and it's heartbreaking. Do you even understand what you are asking of me?
Imagine if Emilia was on her deathbed and she sent you to America and you were in my position, I plead with her.
We have one upset elderly lady at the moment, yes? Leah says. If we do as you ask, we will have two upset elderly ladies. And what do we achieve?
Nothing. Most likely, my grandmother will be as bewildered by all of this as you and I are, and if she never replied to your grandmother's letters, there's almost certainly a reason for that. Please, please stop bothering me here. This is my workplace. I'm about to leave. I'm about to walk out the door and concede defeat. I walk all the way out to the waiting room and head toward the door, and then I think about driving away from this place and living the rest of my life without knowing why Babcia sent me here. It's too late for Babcia to tell me her story. It's too late for me to understand all of the moments, big and small, that led to the family I have in America now. It's probably even too late for me to explain to Babcia just how important she's been to me, and how deep the love I have for her is. But it's not too late for me to plant my feet hard against this carpet and to give this bewildering mystery absolutely everything I have. Leah is my only link to Amelia, my only link to understanding Thomas. Sometimes you have to smash the damn door down. I can't walk away. I just can't give up this easily. I sit heavily in a visitor's chair by the door and raise my gaze to Leah. She's staring at me incredulously. You absolutely cannot stay here, she calls, paying no heed to the confused patients who sit in chairs all around me. I'm not going anywhere until you agree to talk to her for me. I shrug. It's uncomfortable for me to be this difficult. I mean, once upon a time, well, this was kind of the life I thought I'd lead. In my idealistic youth, I really thought I'd be the sort of journalist who uncovered deeply buried truths, a woman who made a way to tell the stories that need to be told. Fine, Leah says, and she sits back at her desk, slides her phone headset back on, and for the next little while, she does a pretty good job of ignoring me. Zofia texts me after a while. Are you okay in there? It's been an hour and I'm getting worried. I glance up at Leah and catch her staring at me. She avoids my gaze, and I hope that's a sign that I'm wearing her down. Leah refused to help, so I'm basically holding a sit-in until she changes her mind. Zofia replies with a shocked emoji, and then a little while later, Let me know if you need anything. I'm just waiting at the cafe across the road. And good luck. Another hour passes, and then another. None of the magazines on the coffee table beside me are in English, but I thumb through them all anyway, trying to look as if I'm not at all fussed about our current standoff. But on the inside, I'm melting down like Eddie on his worst day. My thoughts are an absolute muddle. I'm second-guessing this insane course of action I've set myself on, and frankly, pretty much every single decision I've made in the last week since I decided to actually come here. Doctors come and collect patients, and every single time they stare at me. Patients come in, stare at me, go in for a consult, then come out, stare at me some more, then leave. I feel like I'm on a stage, and the show is something like, Watch Alice Michaels lose her dignity in a foreign country! Leah approaches me around lunchtime, and for a moment or two, I think I've won. Before I can celebrate, she sits heavily in the chair beside me, and she drops her head into her hands. You just can't stay there, she says desperately. You seem like a reasonable person, so I'm going to beg you to reconsider this. I have work to do, Alice. Patients are asking questions, and I can't let this go on. You won't change my mind. I'm not going anywhere until you do, I say simply, and then I raise my chin, hoping I look like Babcia, or even Callie, when they are being overtly stubborn. Leah's gaze narrows, and she sits up again, straightening her spine. Right, you've left me no choice. I've been patient. I've asked you nicely several times, and now I'm warning you. This is a workplace, and if you won't respect my request for you to leave, I have no choice but to call the police and have you removed. Okay, I didn't expect that. I frown at her. Leah, please. 5 minutes, Alice. Then I'm calling the police. I hear Mom cheering me on inside my brain. Sometimes you have to smash the damn door down, Alice. I lean back in my chair and cross my arms over my chest. A much easier way to get rid of me would be to agree to speak to your grandmother. Leah growls and stomps back behind her desk. She's conferring a lot with her colleague, and a few minutes tick down while I busy myself praying with all my might that the police threat was an empty one. I see her pick up the phone, but I pretend I don't notice, because maybe she's bluffing, and obviously I'm getting to her, so maybe if I just hang in here a little longer... The doors swing open a few minutes later, and two policemen enter the room.
They approach the counter, and Leah, wearing a scowl, points to me. The officers approach me.
"You've been asked to leave," the older of the two says abruptly. "We'll give you one last chance to do it voluntarily. After that, we'll be carrying you out, and you'll go straight to our car and then our station so we can charge you with trespassing."
I'm sure they hear my petrified gulp as I rise to my feet and nod. "I'm going," I squeak.
"And madame," the other officer says, as I pick up my bag, preparing to sprint to the door.
"Yes?"
"If we see you here again, we will arrest you."
I shoot one last pleading look toward Leah, who's watching me with her hands crossed over her chest, and then I bolt out the door and back to Zofia's car. Once I'm inside, I collapse into the chair and try to catch my breath.
"Did you just get arrested?" Zofia gasps.
"Almost," I groan, and I cover my hands with my eyes. "I can't believe I did that." Zofia starts the car and drives away at what can only be described as breakneck but legal speed. We're almost back to the highway when she starts to laugh, and eventually I join in.
"You're either really, really determined to do this for your grandmother, or you're completely crazy. I can't really tell which at this point."
"Me either," I admit, the laughter deflating. But it was all for nothing.
"We can come back tomorrow," Zofia offers.
"And do what?" I ask. "Take a free ride to the police station?"
"Well, how would you like to spend tomorrow? Do you have any other ideas? Did she give you anything else to go on?"
"No," I admit, and look back to my phone to start flicking through the photos I took of Babcia's notes and her AAC screen. I read each entry aloud. "Trebinya. Well, we came here."
"Yes."
"Ulitsa Shveltoyanska, 4.
"Her childhood home."
"Yes." "Ulitsa Polarechka, 9B. A beautifully renovated historic home in a gorgeous sweet chestnut-lined laneway. We have no idea why it was important." I sigh heavily. "Ulitsa Dvorchik, 38. The medical clinic where Alexei Shlasky worked." "Emilia Skalski." "Your great aunt."
"Alina Dziak, my grandmother's real name."
"Yes."
"Sol Eva Tikva Weiss." "We have literally no idea." "Prozia Zrozam Thomas." "Your pronunciation is beyond appalling, but yes, she asks us to please understand Thomas.
Which we have no idea how to do.
And that's everything."
"The only other thing she said was, Babcia fire Thomas," I say. Then I groan in frustration. "But I know we think that just means love, which is sweet, but it really
doesn't help us much.
Look, there's a saying in my family, Alice, and I think it applies perfectly to today." I glance at her, and she grins.
"Everything looks better after some vodka."
We try several varieties of local vodka at a restaurant in the square back in Krakow and try to brainstorm other ways we can approach this mystery.
"Okay, let's think about Leah," Zofia murmurs. "Leah's a receptionist, right?"
"Seems to be."
"But her great-grandfather once owned the building. Coincidence, or is there still a family connection?"
"What are you suggesting?"
"Maybe the business is still owned by the family. Maybe Amelia became a doctor too, or maybe one of her children owns it now."
Zofia fishes her phone out of her pocket, and a quick Google search later, we have a list of the GPs at the clinic.
"Agnieszka Trukin is one of the owners. That's got to be Leah's mother, or at least a relative."
We find a few dated and grainy pictures of Agnieszka online, but no social media, and all of her listed contact details point back to the clinic. Zofia is on her phone replicating my search, but I'm staring down at the photos on my own screen. As grainy as those images are, I think I can see a similarity to myself. I turn my phone back to Zofia. "Do you think she looks like me?" I ask her.
"It's hard to tell because the photos are so poor, but yes, it looks like there's a resemblance there. Did you see her at the clinic today?"
"No, there were a few doctors coming out to get patients, but I would have noticed her."
"We could call and ask to speak to her," Zofia suggests. Then she looks at her watch. "It's not quite 5 o'clock.
"They'll recognize my accent," I say weakly.
Zofia grins. "They won't recognize mine."
She finds the phone number on the clinic website, then she dials. I hear her speaking in Polish, but the call ends quickly and her shoulders slump. Agnieszka still owns the clinic, but other doctors do the patient care. She sighs. She retired a few years ago. Of course she did, I mutter. But then I brighten again. What about Amelia herself? We could search for her on the phone directory. Well, she had at least one child, so she's almost definitely married, and given her age, I'd say there's virtually no chance she'd have kept her surname, Zofia says apologetically. We search anyway, but unsurprisingly, my 87-year-old great-aunt doesn't seem to have a Facebook page. After that, we order a second mixed platter of local vodkas, and things get a bit silly. Well, if Leah won't tell us where Amelia is, maybe we could get a private detective to track her down. We could take out full-page ads in the newspapers asking Amelia to contact us. We could break in the medical clinic and see if we can find Agnieszka's address. Maybe I can cancel my return flight and wait in hiding outside the clinic until Agnieszka shows up for a visit and hope she's more helpful, or at least helpful enough to not call the police. Maybe we could steal some of Leah's fingernail clippings and get a DNA test done. Or we could offer a $1 million reward for anyone who solves the mystery. At that, Zofia looks at me. Do you have $1 million? She asks hopefully. I pause, then slump. I'm a stay-at-home mom, so no, not really. Ah, that one sounded promising for a second there. We're laughing a little too loudly when the waiter approaches with the bill, so we go for a walk to clear our heads, then share a delicious meal at yet another restaurant on the square. We chat about everything but my mission while we eat. I tell Zofia about my kids and the difficulties of leaving them. I even skim over the difficulties of leaving Wade alone with them, and the surprising realization I'm starting to form that just maybe I've been holding on to Eddie a little too tightly. Zofia tells me about her work and some of the heartbreaking and hopeful family history searches she's been involved with. I'm totally engrossed with the chat and enjoying the distraction from the awful dead end my search for Babcia has arrived at. Time gets away from us, so I gasp when I see the clock on the wall. I better get back and call my family, I say, but despite the silliness of the evening, I'm definitely feeling better than I was. Thanks for tonight, though, Zofia. It's no trouble at all. I'll walk you back to the hotel, and we'll start again in the morning. She smiles at me gently. Don't lose heart, Alice. We'll think of something. I call back to Wade without texting first, because it's now 10:31 p.m. Krakow time, and that means 5:31 p.m. Florida time, and I know they'll all be home. Callie answers the phone on the first ring, and she's crying. Mommy, she croaks. Baby, I gasp. What happened? Daddy forgot to get me from French Club, and they were closing up, and they called him, but he didn't answer, and Mrs. Bernard got cranky, and I couldn't remember Grandma's phone number, and I didn't know what to do, she says, and then her eyes fill with tears again. A fresh tear slips from her eye, and her voice is small as she whispers, Mommy, can you come home now? Oh, honey bear, I whisper. The buzz from the vodka is fading rapidly. But he got you eventually, right? No, she scowls. Mrs. Bernard drove me to Daddy's work and left me at reception, and the receptionist had to go find him because he was in a meeting. So where was Eddie in all of this time? I ask slowly. Not at school, surely. Oh, no, she says, but before I can breathe a sigh of relief, she adds, He was with Daddy because he got sent home from school today because he had a meltdown in class and he threw a chair at Mr. Bailey. And Eddie had 5 accidents in his pants today, but don't worry, I put his dirty clothes into the washing machine already. Why are you doing that instead of Daddy? I ask, although it's difficult to speak because I am so enraged I can barely focus enough to ask the question. Daddy's in his office on Skype, back to his office. He had to finish his meeting, Callie says. She turns the phone camera around to show me 2 open cans of soup waiting on the bench. Don't worry, Mommy. I'm making Eddie dinner now. No, Callie, no, I gasp. No, you don't know how to use the cooktop, sweetheart. You'll burn yourself. I'm microwaving it, she says defensively. And just then, I hear the ding of the microwave. Callie is plenty old and mature enough to use the microwave or the stove, if she knew how, but I've never shown her, because frankly, she's never had to know. I do almost all of the cooking in our house. It's never even occurred to me that perhaps I should be sharing those duties, not for my own sake, but for theirs. How long did you cook it for, sweetheart? I ask, my heart pounding in my throat.
I guessed. I thought 10 minutes would be enough, she says innocently,
and I grasp the phone a little harder when I see her standing and walking toward the microwave. It sits high on a shelf so Eddie can't reach it. To get that boiling hot soup out, she'll have to reach up over her head.
Don't touch that, I say frantically, and Callie frowns into the camera. But why?
It's going to be very hot, Honey Bear. Just, no. I draw in a deep breath and try to stay calm.
Darling, just do me one little favor, okay? Okay, Mommy.
I want you to go into Daddy's office and interrupt his meeting and...
But he said not to.
Callie, just listen to me, I say urgently. Walk up to Daddy's office and tell him Mommy is on the phone and it's an emergency.
Okay, Callie says. Then she sighs. I just don't want to get in trouble, Mom.
If anyone is getting in trouble, I say fiercely, it's Daddy. She's a child of the millennium, that's for sure. Callie automatically walks to Wade's office upstairs with the camera frontward so I can see where she's going. Then she opens the door to his office to show me Wade sitting at his big desktop computer. I recognize the lab technician who's on the huge monitor, and I also recognize that the scratch pad they are sharing between screens is full of mathematical formulas. I can tell Wade is engrossed, because when Callie walks into the room, he doesn't even look away from the screen.
Not now, Eddie, he says, without turning to see which kid it is.
Daddy, Callie says hesitantly. Mommy wants to talk to you.
I see Wade's shoulders lock. He reluctantly farewells his lab rat, and I notice the slight pause before he turns to face the phone. Now that he's facing me, guilt is written all over his face. Callie flips the camera lens around and passes him the phone. He looks down at the screen, surveys my expression, then sighs and says softly,
Callie, can you give Mommy and me a few minutes?
Don't you dare touch that microwave, Callie Michaels! I call frantically, and confusion filters over Wade's face. But the soup is ready, Callie protests, and Wade's eyes widen.
Callie, go downstairs. Do not touch the microwave. Read a book or something till I finish talking to Mommy, Wade says.
And once the door closes, he raises the camera and stares right into my eyes.
Alice, please don't overreact.
Eddie threw a chair and got sent home from school? You forgot to pick Callie up? Callie is washing Eddie's soiled pants and trying to feed him while you tinker with formulas with John?
I am so furious right now, I do not even know where to start.
Eddie had a bad night, and then he had a bad day. It would have happened even if you were here. There's nothing I could have done to prevent it.
Are you kidding me right now, Wade? I scoff. Of course you could have prevented it. If you had any clue about how to relate to him, you'd have known this morning he was having a bad day, and you could have stayed home with him to ride it out like I would have done.
We've hit a major snag with this plastics project, Alice. I couldn't just stay home with him. My team needs me too. I'm trying to juggle a million things this week so you can be there.
When I called, Callie was just about to get the soup out of the microwave. Soup she'd been cooking in there for 10 minutes.
Shit.
Wade groans, then runs his free hand through his hair.
Well, why doesn't she know how to use it?
That hits a sore spot. She should know how to use it. I'm just in the habit of doing every damned thing myself around that house.
She has two parents, Wade, I say defensively. You could have taught her just as easily as I could have.
He sighs heavily. Then he mutters,
Honestly, Alice, today has just been hell. The very last thing I need tonight.
Callie is 10 years old, I say flatly. Yes, she's gifted, but she's still 10. You can't expect her to pick up the slack because you happen to be busy at work.
I groan and rub my eyes with my hand. I knew I shouldn't have left you guys.
It's one bad day, Alice, Wade snaps. I'm allowed to have one bad day.
But I knew this would happen, I say.
I sound bitchy. I sound like my mother, actually, and I hate that. But I am just so angry I can't stop myself.
I knew you'd let me down.
I have never let you down, Wade says, and now he's furious, too.
Eddie is 7, Wade, I say blithely. You tell me one damn time in all of his life when you haven't let me down.
It's the vodka talking. It's the disappointment speaking. My trip has come to nothing, and I'm going to have to admit to Callie and Bobcha and even Wade that I failed. Regardless, I've said something I can't take back. Something that's just way too far over the line of what's acceptable. Over the screen, I watch as Wade's eyes widen with shock and a deep kind of hurt that I've rarely seen him display. I'm still angry. That doesn't mean I'm not wishing hard that I could pull those words back in. But I can't. And so we both just stare into the lenses of our cameras in stiff, uncomfortable silence. It's Wade's turn to battle to get control of his temper. But in his case, he wins the battle, and he speaks calmly and evenly.
I'm going to go downstairs, he says. I'm going to go check on Edison and apologize to Pascal. I'm going to salvage the soup. I'm going to take over the laundry. Then I'm going to start the night routine and try to get ready for the school day tomorrow.
He draws in a deep breath, then adds,
What I'm not going to do is get into a screaming match with you over FaceTime. I don't think it's a great idea for you to talk to Eddie tonight either. He's pretty fragile today, and I think it would make things worse.
I hang up on Wade without a farewell. Then I bury my face in my pillow, and I give myself over to sobs. But only then does it occur to me that I have yet to call Mom to check in on Babcia. So I drink some water, then I make a cup of coffee, and I watch TV for a while until I feel like my voice might be back to normal and my emotions have cooled. I place a voice call to Mom because I don't want her to see my face. She answers on the first ring.
I can't talk for long, Alice.
What's happening?
Babcia had some kind of turn a few hours ago, and she's been moved to the ICU, Mom says.
I hear the frustration in her voice as she mutters.
I'm waiting for the neurologist, but he's been next door with another patient for half a damned hour. But the nurse said it was another minor stroke. She said it's not uncommon in someone her age, but that it's a concern that it keeps happening.
Is Babcia okay?
She's not okay, Alice, Mom says abruptly. I think it's time we accepted that her days of being okay have passed.
I know her time with us is winding down. Why else would I be in Poland on this wild goose chase? But hearing Mom say those words makes me want to weep.
Can you text me when you know what's happening? I croak.
Alice, I can hear the apology in Mom's voice, but knowing Mom as I do, there's a good chance it's going to be followed up by some kind of sharpness anyway, and I just can't deal with that tonight.
I have to go, I say unevenly. Just text me, okay?
And for the second time today, I hang up on someone I love. 20 minutes later, I'm still sobbing when a text comes from Mom.
The good news is it was a small bleed today, and there's no new damage, but Babcia's condition is no longer considered stable. Dr. Chang is finally organizing that translator for me. She wants to talk to Babcia about whether she's ready to sign a do not resuscitate order. Then a few minutes later, when I'm trying to craft a reply, another text arrives.
By the way, your father arrived a few minutes ago. I don't suppose you had anything to do with that?
Perhaps he's not the only one who should think about coming home early.
I am thinking about it, Mom, I whisper to my empty hotel room. In fact, that's pretty much all I can think about.
Chapter 35. Alina. I thought I'd be terrified while the rest of the truck was loaded. It was surely the most dangerous moment in a series of dangerous moments. But listening to the laughter and jokes of the Nazi soldiers loading the truck made me furious instead of terrified. I knew we must be at Auschwitz, and that meant my parents were possibly nearby. Were these the men who took my parents? Were these the men who killed Saul's family? I was suddenly, overwhelmingly incensed. I had been worn down by the years of occupation, so much so that I'd almost forgotten how to be outraged. But listening to the carefree tinkle of that laughter, a furious, murderous rage surged through me, especially when it occurred to me that Saul was right behind me, hearing that very same soundtrack, probably wondering the very same things. I reached up behind myself and squeezed Saul's shoulder hard. After a moment, he set his shaking hand over mine. Sometime later, we heard the door to the cabin close, and the engine started again. Time lost all meaning after that. For the most part, Saul and I sat in total silence, moving only when numbness or necessity commanded. The suitcase contained preserves jars full of water,
and once each was empty, they were awkwardly repurposed for our waste. I'd packed the last of our rations, biscuits and some jam, along with the very last of Mama's bread, a veritable bounty by Saul's standards, if it only had to last us for a few days. I waited for hunger, but instead, I had to force myself to eat every now and again, and when Saul ignored my offers of food and water, I had to awkwardly shuffle until I could lift the jars and the bread to his mouth. He was a walking skeleton. I knew he simply could not afford to go too long without sustenance, and so I fed him like a baby. I was endlessly aware of the fear and the suffocation and grief for my parents and longing for Tomas, and the itch of the cast and the sting of the splinters that came upon any part of my skin that happened to rest against the wooden crate. It was as if the entire world had paused except for my suffering. Sometimes the truck would slow or stop, and I'd hear voices, and I'd be completely resigned to what felt like an inevitability. This was so surely the end. We'd been discovered. We were done for. Death had arrived. I had failed. But despite the sheer terror, each and every time the truck then started up again, and we'd amble on until the next stop and the next scare. When the noise of the truck was loud enough, I tried to strike up a whispered conversation with Saul. Anything to ease the boredom, anything to distract myself from the way my mind raced with all of the horrible possibilities of what lay ahead of us. Sometimes he answered me in grunts, but mostly he didn't answer me at all. I got the impression that he was sleeping a lot, or perhaps that he'd lost himself altogether in the memories of that night, in the first tender stages of a lifetime of grief, amplified by the terror of our current situation and the sensory deprivation of the entirely dark cavity we were trapped in. Eventually, I accepted that he didn't want to talk, or perhaps he was exhausted to the point that he simply couldn't. Sometimes he'd cry very quietly, and at first I hated that, but I soon realized there was something even worse, because other times he'd fall silent, and I'd feel a suffocating anxiety that he'd died, and I was trapped in what amounted to my coffin, still breathing beside an emaciated corpse. I'd hold my own breath for a moment so I could concentrate on feeling the movement of his chest behind me, just to be sure he was breathing, but sometimes it took me hours to work up the courage to do so, because I knew the reality of my situation. Even if Saul had died, I was stuck in that cavity with him until we stopped, and there was nothing at all I could do about it. By then, the smell in the cavity of the truck was so thick, I felt like I could taste our sweat and waste in the air. A different kind of death. A living prison of our life. I'd lost track of the stops and starts of the truck's journey, so I was startled when it came to a stop, and then I heard footsteps in the tray and cartons shifting around, but no conversation. Saul and I both tensed as the steps came near to us, neither one of us relaxing, even as Jakob called quietly, "Are you two okay in there? We are at the Don River, but we have to hurry. I am running late to the command center to deliver the last of the supplies." He helped us out onto unsteady feet, then lifted us both onto the ground because our limbs were too stiff to climb down. Finally, Jakob passed us the suitcase, and then he started shifting boxes around. It took me a moment to realize that he was trying to get the crate we'd traveled in out from behind the load of supplies. "What are you doing?" I gasped. He glanced at me, confused.
"I need to dispose of the crate and make the last delivery."
"Dispose of the crate?"
"I can't take it into the command center with me," he explained quietly. "If someone tries to unload it, they'll soon realize it's not what it looks like. I'd be done for."
"But you used it once before, with the other courier."
"The front was much closer to home back then, and the resistance unit hid the crate for me until I made the return journey. We're well into what used to be Soviet territory here. I just don't know anyone to hide it for me."
"But there are so many who need your help, so many who..."
I'm not much good to them dead, am I?
Yakub interrupted me, but not unkindly.
I built it once. I can build it again. You best be making your way to the river. I don't know what time your boat is coming. Do you have some food left?
Some, I whispered, but I was reluctant to drop the issue of the crate so quickly.
Maybe you could leave it here. Take these, Yakub said, and he tossed me a handful of carrots.
I didn't catch them. Instead, they scattered around my feet, and I scrambled to collect them.
Try to convince your friend to eat some, too. He looks like he's going to need the sustenance if you two are going to walk soon.
But,
Yakub nodded toward the woods. You ready for this? He asked me quietly. Things are still going to be tough from here, you know.
We both looked to Saul, who had slumped against a tree. It was dawn again. We'd been inside the crate for an entire day, and my companion looked no more lucid after the long stint inside the truck. He was slight, but so was I. There was simply no way I could physically carry him if he stopped walking, nor would I leave him behind. I'd made Tomas a promise, and I intended to fulfill it.
I don't know, I admitted.
Yakub's gaze was sympathetic.
Get moving, girl, and good luck.
Yakub waved towards Saul, who raised his hand in return.
Thank you,
I whispered numbly. I picked up the suitcase and walked stiffly across to Saul. Behind me, I heard the sound of the crate crashing to the ground, and then the splintering crashes as Yakub destroyed it. Tears filled my eyes, but I couldn't let myself look back. Instead, I slid my hand into Saul's arm and led him into the tree line, then helped him to sit on the ground. He slumped forward, elbow on his knee, palm over his eyes. I hastily threw away the jam jars containing our waste, and then withdrew the last of our biscuits and dried bread, and what little water we had left.
You need to eat again, I murmured.
Saul opened his eyes. It was as if he'd emerged from a deep, god-awful sleep, and was, at last, conscious again.
Alina, he said suddenly.
Yes, I said, startled by the unexpected speech. He inclined his head toward me, and he said softly,
Thank you.
I'd feared the river crossing would be an ordeal, but we simply boarded a little boat with a gruff old farmer and were rowed across to the other side. No drama, no tension, no struggle. We were some miles to the west of the front, so while we could hear shelling in the distance, it was certainly no threat to us. If anything, the crossing was a moment of pleasant peace after the most stressful 24 hours of my life. When the boat stopped at the other side, the farmer nodded toward the riverbank. He didn't speak Polish, and neither Saul nor I knew his language. But we murmured our thanks anyway, then moved to climb out of the boat. This seemed to inspire an almost violent reaction in the farmer, who blocked our way with an oar and started pointing to the suitcase.